Welcome to our next Work Healthy podcast. I'm John Ryan, and today I'm delighted to be joined by David A. Clark, Professor Emeritus, Department of Psychology at the University of New Brunswick. David has written a range of books, including the Anxiety and Worry Workbook, which he co-authored with Dr. Aaron Beck, who is known as the father of cognitive behavioral therapy. Also the Anxious Thoughts Workbook, the Negative Thoughts Workbook, and his most recent publication, This is What Anxiety Looks Like. It's clear, when it comes to understanding stress, anxiety, and depression, few are more qualified. And we are privileged to have time with David today. In the interview, he'll compare and contrast stress and anxiety. He'll discuss triggers and symptoms and categorize the main forms of anxiety and share the main treatment approaches, including CBT and exposure therapy. Finally, he will share advice to organizations wishing to support their people with their mental health. I started our interview by asking whether the world is more anxious now than 100 years ago.
So to your first question, I mean, is anxiety on the increase? And if you take as your reference point 100 years ago, I think most scholars would say yes. We are seeing an increase if you look at that kind of long time span. We're probably seeing an increase not only in anxiety disorders, but depression and probably eating disorders and in a variety of other conditions that we maybe include under that rubric of mental conditions or mental illness or whatever. Now, the more interesting question, I think, is if we take a shorter time span, and let's say even the pandemic, so since 2020, has there been an increase in anxiety, and I think we could say depression as well. And I think early on in the pandemic, some of the work that was done, probably not very methodologically rigorous because, you know, we had to rely on surveys and online surveys and quizzes and so on. It did seem like there was a sharp rise in mental health conditions like anxiety, depression, maybe addictions and so on. Just having looked at some more recent studies, let's say 2022, 2023. So now we're getting 1 year, 2 years post-pandemic. It looks like that increase has not sustained. So now there's debate on whether the pandemic in the post-pandemic period has resulted in an increase or not. So there's debate on that, that maybe the increase that we thought was happening as a result of COVID-19 is now starting to wane a bit. Maybe it's not quite as great as we were thinking.
So yeah. It's potentially dissipating a little bit. So there's a bit of hope there, I suppose.
Yes.
And I'm kind of interested to, are some people more genetically prone to actually suffer from anxiety?
So this leads into, I think, to answer your question, I think it leads into maybe even a prior question, which is what is the difference between stress and anxiety? Because I think most people kind of mix the two. In other words, when they're feeling stressed, they may use the word, I'm feeling anxious. And often people with anxiety will talk about feeling stressed, right? So there's this kind of mixture of the two. But I think it's an important distinction to make, because if you look at it, stress is extremely common. It's a natural response. And we could say, who is alive today who has not experienced stress of some form? So stress would be a sense of mental tension, kind of like an emotional response, that it can be triggered by any variety of stimuli. For example, any like a physical trigger or stimulus or a mental stimulus. And what you can think of in stress is, and I like this kind of old definition of stress, is when you perceive that your demands are greater than your personal resources.
Okay.
Right? So, okay. For example, who hasn't been stressed about deadlines, their job performance, maybe, you know, having to do something very quickly, having to learn something new if we're thinking of the workplace. I mean, all of these things are triggers for stress.
Getting to the airport on time.
Getting to the airport on time, exactly.
That's my favorite one.
yeah. You just did that one last task before leaving, and now you're late, and there's traffic and an accident ahead that you didn't expect. That is stress, right? Not necessarily anxiety, but it's stress. And if you think about the symptoms of stress, often there are things like irritability, anger, fatigue, difficulty sleeping, and so on. Now, when you look at anxiety, though, it's a little bit different. So anxiety is kind of a persistent and excessive feeling, again, of tension and worries, but it can, let's say, it can persist beyond the trigger, beyond the stimulus, whatever it is that, let's say, you're worried about. So, for example, let's take your getting to the airport on time. Let's say that is a stressor for most people. It becomes an anxiety issue if you were frightened of flying. The scared of flying would be an example of anxiety, right?
Yeah.
You're worried about it. You're thinking about it maybe days, weeks, could be even months before you actually take the flight. You have a fear of flying, right? So that would be an anxiety condition, whereas being late for the flight would be an example of a stressful situation.
So one is a definitive problem in my life. It's real. And that's causing me a stress. And I feel I'm running out of time. So my ability to cope with that is under pressure. Whereas the other one is kind of a perception I have as to some problem, a threat maybe of crashing and dying that may not necessarily be real. Is that right?
That's correct. So, you know, we've all been told that flying is one of the safest forms of transportation. So logically, you could say I'm about to take a trip on one of the safest modes of transportation. However, if you have an anxiety disorder, what you're thinking about, it could be crashing, you know, the plane crashing, or more often than not with fear of flying, it's the claustrophobic feeling. You know, you're trapped in this. I've had clients tell me I'm trapped in this tube at 35,000 feet and I can't get out. There's no escape. And that is what is making them anxious. They actually have a panic attack as well as a result of that. That would be an example of anxiety. Same situation, flying. Most people can be stressful. Am I going to be late and so on? Am I going to make my flight? For other people with an anxiety disorder, they're thinking about it much more in a much more exaggerated way. They're thinking about the threat, danger, unable to cope. And they're also thinking of how can I avoid this? So that
first piece. So if I am suffering from anxiety, one of the signs is probably that I'm exaggerating or I'm experiencing my emotions at an exaggerated level. Is that right?
That's correct. So if you want to continue, maybe we should even use a different example that would be a workplace example.
Sure.
So let me use this example. So let's say you have a deadline and maybe you're working on something that you're not so confident in. Maybe it's a new area. Maybe the expectations are quite high. The implications for the company are great in terms of your analysis or your report. So you're concerned about this, let's say. You're a bit worried, but that could be a stressful situation. Somebody, let's say, who is has a problem with worry and what we call generalized anxiety, they may start worrying about this report, this deadline, maybe days or weeks before it's due. And when they think about the deadline, they just don't think about, you know, I got to get this done. I got to do a good job. They're more focused on, I'm going to seize up. I'm going to blow it in some way. Maybe they have to make a presentation. So they're thinking, I'm going to be overwhelmed with anxiety. you know, making the presentation to what, senior management or whatever. They get nervous about that. They can imagine their mind going blank when they make the presentation, maybe stuttering, you know, kind of not being able to find their words, maybe being asked an embarrassing question. So they're kind of focused on that the report, the presentation of itself is a personal threat or danger, and they feel helpless to cope with it. That would be an example of anxiety. The first person, concerned about it, works on the report, works on the presentation, but they get it done. It's stressful. Second person, however, it goes one step further, in fact, much further, and it becomes a source of anxiety.
And so are there different levels of anxiety? I mean, you know, oftentimes you'd hear people saying, oh, sure, you're just a worrier.
Yes.
And is worry and anxiety, are they similar, the exact same, just different words to explain the same thing? And then just I'm wondering about the intensity of that anxiety. Is that where it becomes a problem?
So one of the ways that we identify whether something is, and I think actually, if I could step back just a little bit and say, let me complicate it a little bit more. It's not only the difference between stress and anxiety, but there is what I would call healthy anxiety, and then there's unhealthy anxiety.
Okay.
Right? Because again, just like stress, we can say who hasn't felt anxious in their life?
Yeah.
You know, about something. Right. So it's not really possible to go through life without being anxious. In fact, I would say it would be downright maladaptive to our disadvantage to have no anxiety. We might call these people fearless, and it's good to have some fear.
It's a survival mechanism, isn't it? Really?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So if you think about one that I use often with clients in making this distinction between healthy and unhealthy anxiety is taking an examination. I mean, we've all taken tests and exams, and there's something called test anxiety. So let's say before your test, you're worried about your performance. Will I do well? Right. But let's say, and you start worrying, thinking, feeling anxious, butterflies in your stomach, you know, a little tense and so on. Maybe you're having a little bit of difficulty sleeping. But in this case, your anxiety motivates you to study. Okay. It motivates you to prepare for the test, the exam. And probably most of us can remember a time when we were maybe a little overly confident about an exam. Maybe even a little bit cocky about, oh, I know that material. No anxiety. You go in and you get floored because there are questions on there that you just didn't expect, right?
Yeah.
So a little anxiety can be helpful. But then the anxiety becomes a problem where you're so worried about your performance. You're so worked up. You're almost at the point of having a panic attack because you imagine failing the exam. And then maybe you don't get into the program that you want to get in. So there are dire consequences with that. You come to believe that you just don't understand the material. You know, you're not smart enough. You know, maybe there's material you don't understand. You keep focused on that. And so it prevents you from studying. You now can't concentrate. You are so worried, so anxious about the exam. You can't study. You can't prepare for it. You're not sleeping. Maybe you start drinking a bit if you're in college or university to cope with this. So now you're drinking, or now you're using a sleeping aid, or you know you're taking some other substance to try to calm yourself down. But then it's interfering in your cognitive ability and your ability to study. So now the anxiety is not helpful. It's now maladaptive. It's now unhealthy anxiety. And for people with what we call an anxiety condition, the anxiety ceases to be helpful and it becomes very unhelpful, unhealthy.
Okay. And so stress, mild anxiety, then a more intense level of anxiety that actually feeds into actually negatively affecting my performance.
Right.
And then does it progress to depression? Are depression, is it linked to anxiety? Or are they two separate things completely?
So there's a high co-occurrence between anxiety and depression. The usual pathway is that people start with anxiety, and then, you know, as it's prolonged, let's say over years, then the depression develops. It's more likely that you have anxiety and then depression versus depression and then anxiety. And I think it's helpful maybe at this point to stop and say, in at least the mental health area, we tend to think of at least three major forms of anxiety, okay? Mm-hmm. So there is there's panic, what we call panic disorder. That's a person who has panic attacks. These are very sudden onset of an anxiety attack, involves a lot of physical sensations, heart palpitations, dizziness, lightheadedness, muscle tension, or even muscle weakness, I should say, maybe losing one's balance, you know, what we call butterflies in the stomach. Mm-hmm. And it's a sudden onset, usually lasts maybe 10 to 20 minutes or so, and then starts to subside. Oh, difficulty breathing. So the person may start to hyperventilate as well. They feel like they're suffocating.
Yeah.
So this is a sudden onset. Sometimes these panic attacks just hit people out of the blue for no apparent reason. And then there are other times that they're cued or they're triggered. The danger with the panic attack is that it's a very frightening, terrifying experience. And so then people who have panic attacks will often engage in a lot of avoidance. So they start looking around for triggers. Now, where this is important in the workplace is that if a person has a panic attack at work, and it's very common with people with panic attacks that they often happen around other people in public or social situations, right? When you first have a panic attack, you might think you're having a heart attack.
Because it's very similar.
And it feels like that. And often people will rush to emergency, you know, to ER, they'll get checked out. It's concluded they didn't have a heart attack. And so they'll say, oh, it's a panic attack, often given medication and so on, and suggested that maybe they engage in a course of therapy. Mm. But if that happens at the workplace, you see, what happens is that the person says, okay, being at work, I'm more likely to have a panic attack. And therefore, there's the immediate desire to avoid work. You would avoid anything that you think is triggering the panic attack. So you might start avoiding grocery stores, for example, the shopping places, arenas and restaurants and public places, because it seems like you're more likely to have a panic attack outside the home than in the home. Right.
Okay.
You can even in extreme cases become housebound.
Okay.
That's panic.
Incredible, isn't it? So that's the panic attack piece.
That's the panic attack.
That's kind of scary for people, isn't it? I think we'll come in a little while to talk about how we might cope with those situations.
Right.
So panic attacks are the first ones. What's the second?
So another very common one is what we call generalized anxiety disorder. And this is kind of being anxious about a variety of, let's say, common concerns that people have. Now, remember, anxiety is always about the future. You never get anxious about the past. You're always getting anxious about the future and the unpredictability and the uncertainty of the future, right? So what if? So think of it this way. Generalized anxiety tends to be excessive worry. It's the what ifs about the future, what ifs about my finances, my relationships, my work performance, my job security, getting along with my coworkers and so on, my health. People get very anxious about their health.
Yeah.
And so generalized anxiety is more of a mental anxiety than a physical anxiety. So you might feel some tension, some difficulty concentrating, some irritability, You might have problems sleeping, but the main thing is that excessive worry. That's the big component to generalized anxiety.
And would you know the way people express that they get panicky about the how fast time is going, and maybe, you know, worried about dying and the like. I mean, would that be generalized anxiety?
Yeah. So you would, yes, you would probably call that general, if for somebody, for example, who has a fear of dying or is thinking a lot about dying, it's probably taking the form of excessive worry.
Okay.
And they may have feel some tension, and it may absorb their concentration as they're thinking about dying. They're worrying about it. They may be even starting to look for some symptoms, some signs of ill health. And then we would refer to that as health anxiety.
Okay.
Okay. So that's generalized anxiety, very common. And that one tends to persist for years and years and years. So when you asked about causes, that one is often linked to one's temperament or personality.
Okay. So,
a tendency to worry, a tendency to be anxious. An anxious type of person would be at high risk for this generalized anxiety.
Okay, so that's trait anxiety, is it? Is that what you call that?
And that trait is a combination of genetic and environment and so on.
Gotcha.
And then we have social anxiety, right? Which is a very, again, a very common form of anxiety. That's basically feeling anxious around people. And the fear there is of the negative evaluation by others. There's a sense that friends, even family, are making judgments of you. And they're not judging you in a favorable way. You know, they're judging you in a negative way. So often people with social anxiety are concerned about appearing anxious. You know, they don't want people to know that they're anxious. Sometimes it starts in childhood as kind of a shyness, you know, and then develops into anxiety being around other people. And the common way to cope with that is people will avoid.
Okay.
You know, they try to avoid these social situations. So somebody with social anxiety would be very uncomfortable doing what we're doing right now, which is talking.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Thinking about there might be a few people listening on the to this conversation. Yeah. You know, this would be very anxiety provoking. And at the top of the ladder, top of the pyramid for someone with social anxiety is public speaking.
Yes. Yeah.
That's the most terrifying thing they can think of. Now, back to the workplace. How often with many types of work, you know, do you have to make a speech or do you have to make a presentation? Do you have to participate in meetings? And so even though you may not be the center of attention, you're expected to participate. This is a terrifying situation for someone with social anxiety.
Mm. It's interesting because we talk about psychological safety, and one of the things that leaders are told when they're chairing meetings is to make sure to get everybody to speak so they've felt they've contributed. But actually, if somebody has social anxiety, this is probably the last thing they want to do. They just want to put their head down and say nothing.
Absolutely. That would be like, okay, if the person chairing the meeting says, okay, we're going to have everybody participate, I can almost guarantee the socially anxious person will come down with some illness on that day.
And tell me, where do phobias fit into, you know, these range of anxieties?
So phobias are also considered, if you kind of look at the diagnostic, the nomenclature that is used by psychiatrists and psychologists. So phobias would be a type of anxiety condition, but it's very specific. So we talked earlier about the fear of flying. You could have a phobia about flying and you may not have any other fear, but your thing is flying. You absolutely hate, you know, you're terrified of flying. And by the way, it can be very, you really have to ask people what it is they're frightened of. I had a guy many, many years ago, a lawyer who was terrified to fly. And so I was thinking, okay, the height, the crashing, you know, the enclosure and so on. But what his fear was is that as he's going through security, he would lose control of his mental facility and he would shout the word bomb.
Really?
And so he was so preoccupied with this that, you know, it's kind of like inadvertently
like Tourette's
he might
or something.
Say the word.
You yeah. Know? Yeah.
Which is not a good thing to do in most countries. When you're
I should declare I have a phobia myself and it's around elevators. I find it really difficult. Glass elevators, no problem. But enclosed elevators, I find that really difficult to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, see, that's interesting. I've treated people with this kind of elevator fear. And the glass elevator would just be absolutely terrifying for them.
There you go. So, different folks, different strokes.
That's right. It's always, and that's why it's important. One of the first things we always do in treating anxiety disorders is to try to find out what is the anxious concern? What are the triggers? What is it specifically? So we use these labels like generalized anxiety, social phobia, panic disorder, but in a sense, it doesn't really tell us, it doesn't tell us the whole story. I don't even know if it tells us half the story because it can be so different for each individual. So you really, to get a handle on the anxiety, you really have to know what it is. What is it that you're anxious about? What is it that you're thinking about a lot of the time? So as psychologists, as cognitive behavior therapists, we do spend a lot of time on what are you thinking about when you are anxious. And that
is interesting because everybody thinks, you know, it's straight away it's claustrophobia, but then they don't understand that I don't mind glass lifts. I still can't get out of a glass lift if it stops, but the fact that I can see out of it gets over my problems. So, you know, that seems strange to a lot of people.
But,
So they're the main types of anxiety, are they?
Those are the main types. I mean, you know, we can split it off into a lot of different things. I mentioned health anxiety would be another, you know, another type of anxiety, let's say. In the old days, it used to be called hypochondriasis. You know, there are people who are anxious about relationships, for example. Mm. Maybe that's it. So you might work on what is it that you're frightened of. And in that case, the person may have a fear of abandonment or a fear of rejection. And it's not quite a social phobia as such, but they do feel tense or anxious around other people, let's say. So,
So that's really helpful getting a sense of, you know, the different types of anxiety that people can suffer from. And, you know, differentiating stress, anxiety and depression. I suppose the big thing now is how do people cope? I know you've mentioned a few times there, avoidance is obviously a technique that they might use so that they don't actually, don't get into too many lifts or elevators. And maybe trying to push thoughts to the back of my head or maybe, you know, lots of people drugs and alcohol just to try and numb the effect of it. But obviously they're probably not the most useful strategies. There's probably other better ones that you'd suggest. So what would be the main techniques and strategies that people can actually implement?
So one of the most effective strategies we have as psychologists when it comes to anxiety, fear and anxiety, is what we call exposure treatment, right? So let's say that I'm going to take social anxiety because it's a good one, and think of the workplace. Yeah. And so because of the pandemic, which we mentioned, a lot of employers, well, I guess all employers went to remote work for a while, and now they're gradually getting back to some in the office work and so on. Well, you can imagine the person with social phobia is going to be very, very reluctant to go back into the office, especially if they had a year or two of remote work, right? But it may be that the remote work is not particularly good for their anxiety, right? Because they're not having to challenge themselves. So in exposure treatment, what we do it would be in that case, would be to systematic, gradually increase the person's exposure to cues that situations that make them anxious. So if we take the workplace for a moment, we might start out social phobia, might start out with them participating. In fact, I had a guy I worked with not too long ago where this was his case. And we started out by doing virtual meetings. And he would always turn his video off. Right? So, you know, there's a trick. So you have social anxiety, you participate in the meeting, but you turn your video off. So then we started with, how about if you keep turn your video on, right? And even like half the meeting, keep your video on, and then the full meeting. And then once he got used to that, then proceed to, okay, now you've got your full video on. How about if you make a comment? Maybe somebody says, hey, David, you know, maybe ask a question. You might say something like, oh, the weather here today is overcast or cloudy or something. So now you're participating a little bit. You said something. And then we would keep gradually increasing that. And then the next thing we might work on is going back into the office again gradually and so on. And we call that exposure treatment and a working through a hierarchy, starting with something that's not too challenging, not too frightening, let's say, for the individual, and working up to something that would be much more frightening. That turns out to be the most powerful form of treatment we have.
So you'd have me in elevators every day, would you?
Well, we might have to start with, you know, you walking, getting into the elevator and just stepping out. You know, the door doesn't close.
Yeah.
And if somehow I could, maybe maintenance or whatever would give me a key so I could control the elevator, the lift, then I might, you know, we might have the door close for just a few seconds and then it opens and then longer and so on. Yeah. So that would be the principle, yes.
Okay, great. And so cognitive behavioral therapy, you were a student, weren't you, of Dr. Aaron Becht's?
Yes, that's correct.
I mean, so is what you just talked about there, that exposure, is that under the area of cognitive behavioral therapy, or is that something different?
So that would be the B in cognitive behavior therapy. That's the behavioral treatment.
Okay.
Now, what we do in CBT is we also work on cognition, because we know, for example, that how you were thinking about the elevator, or how you are thinking about returning to work if you have social anxiety, is an important element, is really driving your anxiety. So what is it that you're most frightened about, right? So let's say the return to work. And, and let's say the person says with social anxiety, well, you know, my work colleagues can see that I'm very anxious. And, you know, they can see that, you know, when I try to speak, my voice, you know, trembles, gets shaky. Maybe my hands shake a bit. I turn red in the face. I blush. And, you know, they're just as comfortable as anything. So they're probably thinking, what on earth is wrong with Dave? Why is he just, it's just an ordinary me. Is there something wrong with him? Does he have some severe form of mental illness? So these are the thoughts that are going through, you know, my mind, let's say, if I had social anxiety. So as a therapist, what I would do is I would work with that and say, well, what's so bad if they notice that you're anxious? Right? Because there's no sense in trying to convince you that you're not anxious, because you know you're anxious. So saying positive thoughts about, and this is where most people go wrong with this, is they think that positive thinking is going to get them through. Positive thinking will not get you through. You can't think your way through these situations when you have anxiety in a positive way. You can even, if you had a fear of flying, you can't even convince yourself the plane won't crash because, you know, once in a while, every 10 years, whatever the statistics, a plane crashes. And you know that because of the laws of gravity, if the engines stop, the plane comes down. So there's no sense in thinking about it positively. There's no sense in thinking about your coworkers are not going to notice that you're anxious, or to convince yourself you won't be anxious. The cognitive therapist does is, what's so bad if they notice you're anxious?
Mm.
You go to that meeting. So we actually tell people, go to the meeting and be anxious, which is easy to do.
I'm interested in the sort of whether or not what drives the cognitions. Is it sort of feelings, or is it the cognitions drive feelings? Which kind of comes first?
Which comes first, the chicken or the egg, right?
Yeah.
And it is kind of a chicken and an egg situation, because if we take this example, if you go into it and say, I can't let myself be anxious, I can't let the anxiety show, because if I do, then my coworkers, my colleagues, my supervisor, whatever, will make a negative evaluation. They'll think there's something wrong with me. They'll think I'm weak, I'm defective. And so I've got to hide my anxiety. So you try hard to hide the anxiety. But what we know from our psychological research, if you suppress your feelings, if you try not to do, it sometimes makes the feelings worse. So now you're feeling even more anxious because you're trying not to be anxious.
Yeah. And then the worst advice you can possibly get is calm down.
Absolutely. I mean, you know that if you're anxious, you know, look, you keep telling yourself, calm down, calm down, calm down. But your feelings are run away. They're like an uncontrolled freight train or whatever.
Yeah.
It's just heading down this track and you can't control it. So then we say, okay, you're heading down the track. It feels uncontrollable. But is that true? Is it that you would do anything because you have absolutely no control? And so then we do experiments, say, well, I do have some control. Obviously, I know I'm not, you know, bursting out and saying terrible profanities and, you know, on and on, you can imagine. No, I'm not doing any of that. So I must have some control. And then, you know, so that's what we're doing with cognitive therapy, really working on the cognitions. And I use the word, we're decatastrophizing the situation. It's uncomfortable and, you know, it's difficult, but is it a catastrophe? Right.
And I'm fascinated because sometimes, you know, when you're high on emotion, somebody trying to bring logic to the situation, like, you know, if you're scared of flying and somebody says, well, here's the statistics, you're kind of going like, no amount of statistics is going to actually relax my body and calm me down. So I mean, I take it you have to kind of work with people when they're in a calmer state then to go through that logic conversation.
Right. And so sometimes what we do is, you know, you can give people flashcards, or, you know, they put little notes maybe in their phone to kind of remind them of certain things. They recognize that, okay, I'm thinking this way. Yes, I'm anxious. Probably people are noticing it. One of the experiments that, or one of the homework assignments I used to give with people with social anxiety at work, is I would ask them to keep track or to take some notes about how anxious their colleagues seem to be when making a presentation or talking at a meeting or whatever. And what's kind of interesting about that is that when people have social anxiety, become very inwardly focused, self-focused, right? And of course, their performance goes down, because if all you're thinking about is how anxious you are and that everybody's noticing it, you're probably missing all of the dialogue that's happening at the meeting. So now you're really out of the loop. And so if for whatever reason, that supervisor you mentioned earlier, John, who says, we're going to make sure everybody participates.
Yeah.
And she asks you a question and you've been so focused on yourself, you have not one sweet clue. And now you're really embarrassed.
Yeah.
Because you may have to say, I don't know, or ask them to repeat certain elements of the discussion. And now it's not only I'm feeling anxious, but now I appear really incompetent.
Yeah, that's a really tough one, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I mean, with that cognitive behavioral theory and Dr. Beck, is it true? Because I remember listening to one of the interviews you did. I know he passed a couple of years back, and he lived to be 100. And I think he was working on new work and research something like 2 weeks before he died. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. In fact, I have a book called The Anxiety and Worry Workbook that we wrote together, the first edition back in, I think, 2012 or something. And then we were working on a second edition, a revision of it. And I emailed him some work that I had done on the revised manuscript. And I got an email back from him. Yes, I'll have a look at that. And I think a week or two later, he passed.
But like, I think 100 years, we'd take that, wouldn't we?
Yeah, we would take 100 years, exactly.
And to
we
be working right up until the last few days, that's fantastic. And at that stage, I think you were talking about recovery orientation CBT. Is that right?
Now, that's his term, recovery-oriented cognitive therapy. And that really came out of his later work. And when you say later, his 90 plus years or whatever.
Amazing.
The ninth or 10th decade, I guess you'd call it the 10th decade. But he was working with people with very severe mental illness, like people who had been hospitalized for schizophrenia and were unable to function, maybe couldn't function independently, weren't able to work. And so out of that, he refocused cognitive therapy to really help them to formulate some goals, very simple goals in a sense, that they could do. It might be like to improve, let's say a young man might be to improve his basketball or, you know, things like that. And so it was rather than looking at deficits and looking at things, deficiencies, we'll call them, it was looking at accentuating what you could do and enhancing it. So now recovery-oriented therapy is more of a goal-based therapy that kind of looks for your strengths and then building on those strengths.
Okay, that's interesting. So I'm just wondering also one thing about anxiety. Does it tend to come in waves? And kind of, should I, if I'm feeling anxious, realize that it's only going to last a certain amount of time? Is that fair to say, or is that a wrong way to look at it?
So some of these conditions I mentioned, like panic disorder, particularly generalized anxiety or social anxiety disorder, they're very persistent. And so people have tended to deal with these things over years, even decades. I guess you could say it might come in waves depending upon the triggers. So if you do a lot of avoidance, you're fine as long as you're avoiding. But then maybe you're not doing so fine when you're confronted with a situation that triggers your anxiety. So, you know, if you have agoraphobia or acrophobia, however you, whichever side of the Atlantic you're on, you know, you're fine because you're avoiding the stores, you're avoiding shopping malls, you're avoiding supermarkets, you're avoiding restaurants and so on. But then if you're in a situation such as, you know, you find yourself around other people, then that's when the anxiety gets terrible. I remember as a graduate student, I did my graduate work in London long, long time ago. And in my my practicum, one of the first clients I was referred to, was a man probably in his 50s who had not ventured from his home in 25 years.
Wow.
He never stepped out of the front door.
I mean,
very, very severe. And, you know, it's hard for us to imagine how could that be.
Yeah.
But you see, he felt comfortable, more comfortable at home. Soon as he closed the door to his front door, even walking down the front steps into the gate was monumental. It was a terrifying experience for him. So he avoided it. So his anxiety was under control in a sense, as long as he stayed at home.
Okay. And finally, just because I've taken too much of your time already, I'm just interested if I could ask you just to kind of summarize those main things. But just one thing people often say to me about thought loops, and sometimes they get stuck in thinking and they can't stop thinking. It becomes compulsive. Is there anything that you'd suggest there as a way to help them to try and stop that?
So one of the things we know about mental control, which is really what you're talking about, if you get stuck in some kind of a loop, a way of thinking, is one problem is that mental control is, in a sense, a paradox. I've used the term the paradox of mental control, which is the harder you try not to think about something, the more you'll think about it, right?
Yeah.
And so we have... There was a psychologist at Harvard, Dan Wegner, did a number of very famous, well-known experiments called the white bear experiments, where he had people don't think about a white bear. And when people went through a period of suppression, don't think about a white bear, then in the subsequent period, they had more white bear, what we call intrusive thoughts, than the people who were allowed to think about a white bear. So there seems to be something, the harder you push against a thought, the worse it gets. So don't think about this, don't think about whatever it is. The more you say that to yourself, and the more you try not to think about it, the more you will think about it. So we try to encourage people to do the opposite, which is a thought is a thought. Right. So you let
which means you let the thought out.
You let the thought go. And in sense, you then see how well you can and kind of get yourself involved in some other things, even though you have the thought. Most of us can have many thoughts while we're doing the dishes, washing up dishes, or doing some simple tasks at work. And so the thought intrudes. There it is. It's an upsetting thought. You don't want to think about it. You might even talk to it. Some of my colleagues kind of make a game out of it. You talk to the thought and say, well, okay, there you are. You're in my mind again. It's okay. You can sit there. I'm going to get on and do X, Y, and Z. Probably it's not the time to do something complex and difficult like calculus or whatever, but you do something fairly routine and simple. And to kind of keep yourself, and it's okay, it's a thought, it's there in my mind, I'm not going to try to push it away. And in a sense, you've probably heard this term mindfulness, and that is kind of the principle of mindfulness. As soon as you make a judgment about the thought, you know, I must not think, this is a bad thought, this is destroying my health, I won't be able to function, I got to get rid of this thought, which is often what happens in anxiety conditions, it'll get worse. So the best thing to do is say, okay, it's there. Okay, there you are. And let's see if I can just get on with things a bit.
So don't suppress, get it out. I think I heard somewhere you talked about a worry balloon, kind of the idea of popping it and letting the, taking the air out of it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic. Listen, it's been so good to talk to you and to get an insight about all those things, because there's so much involved in this. And one of the things that probably bothers me most is that most people, we think all the time, but yet very few people have been skilled and trained to manage our thoughts or to construct, even understand how we think. And help ourselves, because it's so important. It really is. If there is an organization who wants to support people, what can they do?
Well, I think one of the first steps would be for organizations, companies, organizations to recognize the importance of mental health issues, and and to really, I would say that's the first one. If you can see mental health problems on the same level as we all recognize physical health problems. And I know for many people, they might be reluctant to admit something to an employer about a mental health problem because they would immediately be concerned that they're going to be judged as weak, maybe incompetent, maybe as a kind of a drag on the company, that it could put their job security at risk. So I think organizations and companies that can be more receptive, let's say, would be the to mental health issues would be the first step. And then I think, and a lot of companies I know are doing this, is also making provisions for people to reach out and get help through their employment. So a lot of companies I know have employee assistance programs, right? And those are really, really good. I think they're really good for dealing with stress issues, but there needs to be an avenue from the employee assistance program for the individual with an anxiety condition to get more intensive treatment. Treatment that's probably not really available through the employee assistance program. And I think maybe a lot of companies fail to see that there is a difference between the two. The employee assistance is often time limited, a few sessions, and a really good intervention for stress management and maybe suggesting some lifestyle changes and so on. But for somebody with a more enduring and difficult anxiety condition, they probably might need more intensive treatment referral. So companies that would have some kind of pathway to facilitate that and encourage that, maybe with a little bit of time off, at least some time off to, to make appointments. The other thing I would say, I have worked with organizations where my clients have been off on stress leave, what we call stress leave or work leave. And it really is because of a mental health condition like anxiety or depression or whatever. And there's an attempt to the return to work program is developed and often participating in these return to work programs. They work they work quite well if your job is very kind of concrete and you can say, okay, you're going to go into the office for, 2 hours a day and then 3 hours a day and so on, you gradually increase it. What becomes more difficult is for the return to work programs to look at the type of work that the person does. And because of course, most work now is fairly complex. There'll be tasks that are very difficult, very anxiety provoking and stressful. And as a psychologist, CBT psychologist, I always wanted to build in that hierarchy, starting with the simple tasks, let's say the easier tasks, more comfortable, and working up to the more difficult ones, like that big presentation or report. And I often find that's much more difficult to build into a return to work often. So recognizing the need for maybe a more complex return to work program would also be very helpful, I think.
Listen, thank you so much for all the work you do, for the books you've written. It's hugely inspiring and it's really, really helpful because it helps people out of a deep hole that they can be in. And it's a lonely place when you feel that you're struggling with your own mental health. So thank you so much for your time today. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, and thank you very much, John, for this opportunity to speak to you and participate in your podcast.
I really hope you enjoyed that interview with David A. Clark, a world expert on anxiety. Next up on the Work Healthy podcast, we're off to India to discover their unique approaches to making work healthy. I'm John Ryan, and thanks for joining me today. And remember, we'd love to hear your ideas on who you'd like to see us feature here on the next Work Healthy podcast. Please connect in with me on LinkedIn.